long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me, whatever it is, you'll live. Learn more at StopTextsStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. KPFT Houston.
Good evening. It is 8 p.m. Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I am your host, Hank Rubicek, and along with the best team on radio, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Eric Heen, Christy Gorman, Harwood Taylor, and Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on astonishing journeys before returning us safely to the present. If you join us every week, you notice that our usual intro was a little different tonight. I decided to grab my fiddle and play a tune. Yeah, I wish. What you enjoyed was Meditation from the opera Thaïs by French composer Jules Massenet. It was performed by childhood friend Bruce Patti, violinist for the Dallas Symphony, music that brings us comfort in times when we need it most. And along with another buddy from my youth, Steve Weintraub, they are about to deliver a few stories just right for the season. Images of family that prompt everything from gratitude to embarrassment. Okay, guys, we're finally together, right? We kept it so wild, we're on the radio. But Steve, have you done radio before?
I sold print advertising for a radio station, an NPR station. So,
Okay.
But try and do that.
Okay, and Bruce, you've been on the radio, right?
Well, I've played on the radio.
It's the same thing. I mean, you know, I played on the radio. What else are you going to do? You're going to do stand-up?
You're a musician. I haven't interviewed on the radio. I have not done an interview radio. So this
this is going to be close to an interview, but more importantly, guys, you have great stories to tell, and we're going to really our listeners tonight because, you know, of all the years I've been doing this, we haven't had many programs that have really showcased childhood stories, childhood memories, and there's something very, very special about that. Our Facebook page contains a bio for each of you, but I wanted to tell our listeners about you guys because the information is subtly connected with some of your stories. Bruce, let's start with you. Bruce Patti earned performance degrees from Indiana and Yale. Besides being a violinist for the Dallas Symphony, he was concertmaster for the Yale Philharmonic, Chattanooga Symphony, and principal violin in several music festivals. He toured internationally with famed conductors like Henry Mancini and Andrew Litton, just to name a few, and was concertmaster for Aaron Copland's The Tenderland. He also directed a variety of chamber music concert series, many of which generating thousands for charity. As a published author, Bruce has garnered awards for the very prestigious American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. Dedicated to fostering a classical music awareness for our children, this critically acclaimed artist currently performs in the Metroplex area through the Dallas Orchestra's Symphony Yes program. Bruce, what is the Symphony Yes?
Well, you know, the Dallas Symphony, they break up into small chamber groups, and we go to schools and we play educational programs to introduce the kids to these musical instruments. Like, there's a brass group, there's a woodwind group, a few string groups. I play in a string trio and a string quartet, and we'll give them a timeline. We'll play short excerpts, talking between the pieces. And in some of the schools in the underserved community, we'll identify talented kids and we'll give them free private lessons.
No kidding. Wonderful. That program has got to be successful. It's been going on a while.
Yeah, it's been going on for, we're trying to just encourage more ethnicity in our in the music ranks. And we've brought some professional musicians to the ranks, and a lot of school teachers, like good music teachers, and players.
Beautiful, beautiful. Bruce, Steve, and I are from Cleveland, Ohio, and Bruce and I went to Canterbury Elementary School in Cleveland Heights, and just the other day talked about our class photos with all us boys, you know, standing there, forcing a smile, pants hiked up to our chins, some clad in suspenders and fake neckties, a goofy bunch if there ever was one. Some 60 years later, you're now a guest on the show. How are you at naming some of our classmates?
Well, you know, who can forget?
Now, theoretically, we're old. We should be able to do that and forget what we had for breakfast.
Well, we've had reunions, but despite that, who can forget Karen Snyder or Eileen Abramovitz? And, you know, of course, our playmates, the Skolnick, Steve, you know, Dan Skolnick, Steve Feinberg, those guys.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned those two young ladies. Who could forget Karen Schneider and Eileen Abramovitz?
I have crushes on them to this day.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that takes care of one question I was going to ask you a little bit later. Yeah. Me, I was Alexis Kingslinger. I think.
Yeah.
You remember her? Yeah. You know, she was a very, very, very attractive 8-year-old. And when you're 8 years old, I mean, you know, I mean, you just kind of blend, you mesh, right? Well, your first story is a family yarn consisting of a medley of quick hitters told in sequence and joined by a theme common to a lot of youngins, and that's self-exploration. Tell us the story.
Well, you know, back in first grade, and that's going way back, we used to walk to school, you know, in those days. I remember seeing you walk to school down Scarborough and then down Princeton Road and over to Canterbury. And we'd be out in the playground, you know, before school started. And there was a kid that, you know, a real scrawny little kid. I kind of thought I would be his guardian angel. You know, this guy, he was a kind of feeble kind of guy. And sure enough, there was a bully picking on him in a playground. He pushed him to the ground, causing the little kid to cry. That enraged me, so I pushed that bully to the ground. That bully gets up to me, starts arguing with me. Why'd you do that? Well, you shouldn't have pushed that kid to the ground. Don't do that. And he says to me, I'm going to go to the principal about you. You know, okay, you go to the principal. It's okay, fine. And then forget about it. The bell rings. We all go to the class. It's I forget about it. But 20 minutes later, sure enough, the principal shows up at the classroom and says, and the bully's with her. I know they're looking for me. Will everybody please turn this way, look this way? Well, I don't. Everyone else does eagerly. And I expect the principal to say, and you too over there by the window, you turn too. But instead, she says, okay, thank you. You can turn around now. And that was the end of that, I thought. But that evening at dinner, you know, there's seven of us around the table, five boys, my mom, my dad. My mom says, hey, guys, how was your day? Anything interesting happen? And it's kind of quiet for a minute. And Brian says, I had to go to the principal's office. And she said, well, why? Well, this boy said I pushed him to the ground. I had no idea what he's talking about. You know, Brian is my identical twin brother. It's the first time it really was an advantage to have an identical twin brother. He had to get the rap. And the thing is, the boy, yeah, I talked to Brian just a week ago about it, and Brian says, yeah, I remember him. He was smiling when he saw me in the classroom. He's got me. And I had no idea who he was. I just figured he had the wrong guy. Well, Brian, didn't you ever think that maybe your identical brother was responsible? Oh, no. I just thought I just picked the wrong guy. So that was the first grade story. But, you know, I have, you know, memories with Brian, you know, back even before that, because maybe because we're twins. Like, we're in the playpen. I mean, so how old are we? Maybe one or two. And Brian walks up to me in the playpen, and he starts waving his arm, come on, let's go, you know. And because I'm just leisurely just sitting by the wall there, and oh, man, civil rivalry, right? Sibling rivalry. So I now have to get up and learn how to walk. And I get up and I try and I fall down, get back up, fall again. This continues on and on. And there's no adult around. There's no reason to, you might as well not cry because there's no one. I think she just put us on the porch in this big, huge playpen, me and Brian together. So that was an early memory, trying to learn how to walk. Is that interesting? But even before that, and I want to mention this to your viewers, if anyone remember being an infant, because I remember waking up in this small body and hearing voices, high voices, like they were determined later, where they were women, my mother probably, and some aunts, and maybe a grandmother, and very high-pitched speaking. I couldn't understand a word they're saying. So I did do so. I got to learn a new language. I don't know where I am. But I'm thinking in my own language, which I figure is English. And then an animal starts sniffing in my ear. I figured later it was the family dog. And they got all excited and they whooshed the dog away. And I said, well, this is just too much to compute. So I'm going to zone out. Well, that's a crazy first memory. But getting back to Brian. Yeah, we used to switch classes in elementary school back, you know, around the fourth grade. You were in my fourth grade class, Hank.
Yeah.
And I had to go to Mr. Stevens' class, and that was Brian. So Brian came to Miss Cass' class. Well, it backfired. I had to do multiplication tables, and he had a stopwatch. He's going individually. We're all standing in a circle. He's going, and he was a stopwatch. We had to do these multiplication tables and division tables. And I got flustered, and I started whimpering. I had a bad day. Well, Brian, in Ms. Cass' class, he gets elected class president. He has a great day. But, you know, I don't know. I can go on and on. I mean, there was the music festival. Brian has a girlfriend. And he says after a week, you know, I don't think I like her. You know, she plays violin. Maybe you'll like her. Well, of course I like her. She's beautiful. Why? Well, you know, Brian says, there's a clarinetist I have more interest in. So he goes to the clarinetist. And I, well, you know, if she likes him, identical brother, she'll like me. And sure enough, we hit it off and we're a couple for the rest of the summer.
Unbelievable. Let's give Brian a little bit of a plug. What is he doing right now?
Brian plays the clarinet still. He's up in Chicago. He's a band leader. He's an educator. He's got some university positions and he teaches. He gets musicians together and he'll front the band and play solos. And he likes to do the big band repertoire in particular.
Beautiful. You know, you just gave us a sort of a medley of beautiful short stories. And I was suggesting that the theme is self-exploration. Is there a lesson in those stories that you would categorize as a takeaway? What do you think?
Well, it's...
I mean, they're your memories
not
for
too
a reason.
Much. Oh, you know, like, I'll tell you what. Two wrongs don't equal a right, right? I shouldn't have pushed the bully on the ground. So there's a lesson. I did that. Why? Well, you know, I knew that, but right. I didn't want the principal to have to tell me that. I wanted the principal to tell Brian that.
Well, you know, there are a lot of adages that we learned growing up, and it's growing up and experience those things that reinforce them. There's no question about that. Steve Weintraub began his career as an ad person and intern at NPR affiliate WKSU-FM, at Kent State University. He's a seasoned media specialist. Steve was a newspaper and magazine advertising rep through 2010. A career change a decade ago pushed Steve into a new vocational path. And although his specific occupations are a bit of a mystery, he asserts that each of his past three jobs requires that he push and drag measuring wheels around with him. So you have to use your imagination. But he's got five kids in all. And I love this description. He says, I've got two kids of my own doing and three not of my doing. He says, I call them my biologicals and non-biologicals. And that really tells us a lot about Steve's positive take on life. He's got a relentless devotion to grandparenting, and it's really off the proverbial chart. He's got five grandkids, ages 5 to 12, all in Dallas. He and his wife, Ann, are community-driven and together served as directors, presidents, program chairs, and board members for a plethora of organizations. There's no question, Steve, that grandparenting rocks. Mine aren't local, and sometimes it's a little painful not being near them, especially this time of year. What do your grandkids call you?
Well, my first one, she's 12. She called me Grampy, and that stuck with all the others.
She set the trend. Right.
All the way she down to age 5 months. So
you're Grampy Steve.
I'm a Grampy, yeah.
That's good. That is good. I love it. Okay.
Well, I might add, you know, 2 years ago, I only had one grandchild. That was really easy for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And now we're up to five in just the last 2 years. So I tell people we now have a management problem as opposed to one was easy.
But I'll tell you, it is a good, good management problem. And you know, justifiably so, your kids and your grandchildren are so embedded in your life. I thought it made sense to start with your story called Kids, Leave Those Teachers Alone. Tell us the story.
All right. Well, like you guys, I came from Cleveland Heights, Ohio. And my early life, and this was against my, out of my control, I went to parochial school, a Jewish parochial school for 7 years. And it gave me I finally said, I can't do this anymore. I got to go to public school. I want to be around girls and such and have a social life and not be in this constrained, what I thought, community. But I had a marvelous education in Jewish studies. And regular English studies as well. So, but I had never used it from that point on till about 2000. I decided I wanted to try teaching. So where I go to synagogue, it's Temple Shalom in Dallas here. I went to them and told them about myself, said I'd like to do something with the kids. And they said, well, how about we try you out at substituting? So I did that. Walked completely into the dark on that whole thing. What happens then is I said, I need to figure out how to control a classroom because they were not just sitting there waiting for me to show up and then be cooperative. They were running over me. One of my friends who also was a teacher there was an Israeli lady, former IDF, tough as nails. I said, I got to go sit in on her class and see. She's like the consummate disciplinarian, so I monitored her class a few times, learned a few things. The following year, I became a fifth and sixth grade teacher. I had a marvelous assistant who came from New England. We called him Mr. Boston. That's how he wanted to be referred to, but he brought a lot of games and a lot of teaching techniques that I picked up from him. And that really started me on my way. So started to enjoy it, able to control the classroom, I thought. But in those same years, I had seventh graders. And I didn't have an assistant for those classes. We had fifth and sixth graders with Mr. Boston for 2 years. But when you're a new teacher, and you don't know any better, they throw you in with the seventh graders, because that's the worst tweener age that absolutely is out there. They are terrible. They kill you in the classroom. I have the most respect of any teachers, and I learned their secret through my own kids when they went through junior high, is that you have to match their energy with your own energy, because they will totally ignore you the whole time. You're not there. They're there amongst each other, and they're just there to give you a hard time when they do acknowledge you. So I hung in there for 3 years and got better at it. And it sounds like a terrible story about seventh graders, but I give them one credit. I will get in front of, you know, if you want me to do the State of the Union address to millions of people, if you want me to do the rebuttal for it, I have the ability to do that now with no fear. I credit those seventh graders for doing that for me. So my favorite teaching story.
Fabulous. Yeah. You know, if you, you know, the story of the tortoise and the hare and the parable is slow and steady wins the race. If you had to construct a parable for this story, what would that parable be?
Hang in there. And if you want to do something, hang in there, get good at it, and you will prevail. I do have one funny teaching story I wanted to leave with you, if I could.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So we used to, on the first day of class, always have get acquainted time. We'd have each kid introduce themselves, tell a bit about them. I changed it up 1 year. This happened to be a class that I had the same kids for 3 years in a row. And I said, I split them into groups and I said, interview each other and you can tell me what you found out about your partner. So they did that. It all went well. And then they all said to me, Mr. Weintraub, tell us about yourself. I said, and this was really a dumb question as it turned out, I said, well, what do you know about me? So one of them pipes up, you've been married 3 times. In front of everybody.
Yeah, right. And
I don't recall ever telling him that.
Right, and that was just in 1 year. Did you tell him that was just in 1 year you were married 3 times?
Yeah, I didn't tell him that. I was like,
it's amazing. Anyway, it's amazing.
I think I was relating a story about I was married all those times, but I finally found the right one by staying within our faith and culture, but they took it a different way, obviously.
Very interesting. You know, it's really ironic, and I just want to share this with you that, you know, I've been married 3 times, too. The first 2 times with people, it's 2 women in my culture and faith, and finally someone outside of that faith. And she knows more about my faith than the other two. It's funny how things work.
That would be Mrs. Weintraub number two.
Very, very special connection. You also have a story with a title that only you can create. Here I am, Rock You Like a Hurricane. And this one's about gratitude, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely about gratitude. Okay. This goes back to not summer of 2004. My son, Eric, and I, who was very into reptiles at that time, I mean, crazy into reptiles, even had a business going on the side, selling reptiles. He was dealing with breeders and even people that put on shows on the national scale, they would ask him to find animals for him. I mean, it was incredible. And so I get dragged into this thing, and he wanted to go to the biggest show in that particular field, the Reptile Expo, which was in Daytona Beach that summer. So this trip didn't start off very well. My car that I'd had for many years, a few years that I've actually had to take from the company because they weren't providing cars anymore, it died. We called it the Chevy Malibu because it was just a problem from the start. So it died. I rented a car. 18 hours before we leave, we were able to come up with one, and we started on our way. First, we were going to go to a trade show in Biloxi, Mississippi at the Beau Rivage, which is just like the Mirage in Las Vegas in the miniature, brand new at that time. So he loved it there, by the way. It was, you know, adults love to go to casinos, take a 13-year-old there. He had arcade. He had food 24/7, buffets. So we did our show. And that worked out great, along with the casino hotel experience. But we proceeded on there to go make calls on my customers on the way to Daytona Beach. And everything was going fine till one day we were in the St. Petersburg area, and all of a sudden there are all these cars in this gas station. And all these gas stations we were going by, we were trying to find gas, they were all just crowded as could be. So Hurricane Charley was coming up the east coast of Florida. So this is my first experience with a hurricane, or what happens around a hurricane. So so us and 450,000 people, once we got our gas, are trying to move west across from St. Pete to... So I am so smart to my son, I'm showing off. We didn't take I-4. I said, we're going to take the Suncoast Highway. So I'm trying to brag to him, your dad knows some things about Florida. You're in good hands. So so that was a couple-hour trip over to Daytona. And so Charley decides, it comes ashore at Port Charlotte at 165 miles per hour, and it's supposed to go up the coast. Well, no. It's going to take a right turn and now go up the East Coast right at us. So what are we going to do about it? I was like, holy, holy cow. So we make our way all the way to Daytona. And, you know, Florida's a very narrow peninsula. So where are you going to go? This thing, you don't know where it's going to turn. Is it coming our way? Is it not going to come our way? Is it going to head for New Orleans? So if you don't, so I said, we're going to keep the hotel room. And if this is the biggest mistake, so be it. So I said, well, we're at least, we're going to go out in style. So, you know, we went to the grocery store, bought every sugary item we could think of, you know, Cokes, beverages, potato chips, you name it. I said, we're going down in style. So the magazine I worked for at that time coincidentally had a safety emergency response issue going on. And I was thinking, oh, my God, what irony. Here we are. I'm living with the issue that we're about to close. And having had experience in this area, I know that, you know, you cannot change an outcome, but you can minimize the damage. So that was our thinking in going shopping, and we're going to go drink and we're going to go down having fun if we go down, and maybe even survive this thing. So so we were going along pretty good, and nothing going on. It did come through Orlando to our south and headed our way. But that's when the reports ended. It then told us what had happened while it was in Orlando. And I'm like, radio, tell us what's coming at us. No news of that whatsoever. So we're just sitting there waiting, waiting, waiting. And about 11:30 that night, it shows up. And so I, you know, I go look outside. I'd never seen a hurricane before. And you just see the bending palms. It was only about 90 to 110 miles an hour by the time it got to us. And I thought at the time, this is just like a Russian novel of a Texas tornado. I've never seen trees bend like that for hours, not just minutes, you know, tornado here and gone. But so that's going on. And then I'm looking out the, we went back in the hotel room. We did order in a pizza, supposedly we could get a pizza during that beforehand. But one of the, our the person in the room next door to us says, pointing at my car, he said, your window, the windshield blew in. So I'm thinking, and not thinking very well, I said, I went and got a blanket from the room and I'm going to go cover up the windshield. So the windshield actually broke because the pebbles off the roof of the hotel to our south actually blew off, and you know, we had a tire flat and the windshield went out. So I go out there with this blanket, I throw it on the window. Of course, it goes blowing off into oblivion. Stupid idea. I don't know what I was going to do with it. But my son comes out of the room at that point to see what's going on. And the door shuts behind him. And I said, you did bring a key with you, did you not? And he says, oops. So now we're locked out of our room in this hurricane. And luckily, the shape of the hotel is a U-shape. So we're somewhat shielded because it's going north to south, not east to west, thank goodness. But we go looking and, you know, picture us going through the hurricane to the office. And we find the maintenance guy, who we happened to meet that afternoon, saying, we need help with getting back in our room, and we need our, we had a crack in our, you know, picture window to the hotel room. So he is coming with us. He's talking to us along the way as we're making our way back. Well, he's obviously got drunk. We met him earlier in the day, as I said. And so anyhow, we got taped. He taped the window while he's drunkenly talking to us. And I thought, well, why not get drunk, you know, while all this is going on? So next day, everything, we went to our show. They did have a show. That night, we were able to get a car. It was the very same Taurus like the one I had rented. So it's as if the following day, we were, it never happened. You know, we went off in the same car, same everything. So we survived Hurricane Charlie, and quite an experience.
Well, it's a little different from what the rock group Scorpions had in mind, but a very cool nonetheless. Good. Yeah, hurricanes, yeah, I don't even want to go there. I have no fond recollection of anything that requires a flood. Not at all. Not at all. How did you feel as this story unfolded in your mind? Because this was a pretty comprehensive story. But, you know, in about 30 seconds, how did you feel as you were telling the story? Because you look pretty contemplative. Like you were thinking about it.
Scared. You know, that was my first inclination. Very, very scared.
You revisited that fear.
I revisited that fear. I had to be parental at the same time. I couldn't show my fear. Grateful that, you know, we did some very dumb things along the way. You know, we did try to make a good thing out of a bad thing along the way, but grateful that we survived. It could have gone very badly because we just had the ocean to our left, and, you know, it could have come from that way. I mean, things could have gone very wrong.
I'm always fascinated and really inspired by the reasons we choose the narratives that we tell, and as well as some of the artistic experiences that touch us. Bruce, I wanted to circle back for a moment to the piece that you played at the outset of the program. I asked you to play anything you wanted, and you chose meditation. You actually gave me a menu of things, and you chose meditation. You know, in just a few seconds, why was that one of your options? Why was that an important one, you thought, to play at the beginning of this program?
Yeah, I played that piece first time in Chattanooga Opera. It's a interlude before the last act of that Thais opera. And it lays well on the violin. I played it for weddings. I played it for memorials too, but mostly for weddings. I played it at Steve Weintraub's wedding. I played
Number one. Dan,
was that? Yeah. And the bride was late. Remember that?
Right. Yeah. Well, that should have been a sign. Yeah. When you're late to your own wedding.
I could have played it three times for your wedding, sounds like. Yeah. You had three weddings, huh? But anyway, I played the Dan Skolnick's wedding, I played my nephew's wedding, my niece. Well, I didn't, you know, by the time I got to my niece, I said, you know, I'd rather not. I'd rather just watch the wedding this time. And my brother, Doug, he calls me, you son of a blank blank, you're not going to play my daughter's wedding. You can just go blank, blank, blank.
Right.
So, I can't get away with it. I got to play that piece. It's a beautiful piece.
Well, you know, music clearly ignites a lot of memories for you. And this next one actually stars an instrument. I'm looking forward to this story. You call it a key moment. Tell us.
That's a good title for it. Yeah, it's the piano story. You know, after Chattanooga, I was a concertmaster there, and I had to get to Mexico because, I mean, the Chattanooga did a great job, but it didn't pay very much. And I had this opportunity to go to International Orchestra in Mexico City. It was going to do tours. And sure enough, in 2 years, I did go to South America and Europe and Asia. And we had famous soloists. We had famous conductors. I had Leonard Bernstein conducted this orchestra. We had foreigners from everywhere playing this orchestra. But anyway, we would play a concert three times at three different locations in Mexico City. And this one concert was going to feature George Bolet playing the Brahms piano concerto. Well, we go down to Zocalo, where this historical theater is. You open the concert with an overture, then we have to clear the stage so the piano can be rolled out, and they get it in place. We come back on stage, and the concertmaster plays the A for us to tune. And I hear this sound from the audience I've never heard before. It's like this groan. It's louder and louder and louder, crescendo, crescendo. What's going on? I never heard that sound before or since. And I look at the concertmaster, and he had just played the A, and he's watching the piano roll towards the auditorium seats. Why didn't we get up and stop this piano? I can't understand why. He was there, and he kind of reached for it, but it was too late, but it was on a momentum. It was on a suicidal mission, this piano. The wheels were not locked. There was a slope to the stage. So it gets to the lip of the stage. The piano drops, the front legs drop. The back legs continue to push the piano towards the audience. And I'm thinking, at this point, I hope it does a somersault for everybody, but actually it does. It flips over into the front row of the auditorium, and we're amazed about this destruction. George Bolette's off stage. He can't play his concerto. This was a new piano. He could only play in Baldwin pianos. They had to search all over the country for a Baldwin piano, a 7-foot Baldwin piano. But I was concerned about the stage crew. You become friends with the stage crew. They had rolled out the piano and didn't lock the wheels. But no one got fired, and that's good. But, my friend was playing in the orchestra in the first desk next to the concertmaster, the overture, Guido. And Guido didn't have to play the piano, the piano concerto. So he, during the piano move, he'd gone out into the auditorium to watch. He had just waved hello to the gal in the front row, and he's now back there. He sees the piano laying on the front row, and he said, "Oh, gee, I hope she got out of the way." Can you imagine the obituary? The piano hits you, and that's the end of it. But no, he sees her at the intermission. Oh, thank goodness you're okay. But you're in that front row. I just waved you. You're always in that front row. What happened? And she says, "Oh, God told me to move." Well, quite an event. But let me just say that George Bolette, I wonder if he had any recall. So I looked him up. He had an interview with the New York Times 5 years before this incident. And fortuitously says this, "Don't take up a concert career. It is one of the most heartbreaking, impossible, and difficult things that anyone could wish for. Believe me, I know."
Well, I am really glad about Guido's sense of empathy for that woman. That's amazing. I mean, that is absolutely, unconditionally a miraculous escape. No question about that. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to So What's Your Story with guest storytellers and childhood friends Steve Weintraub and Bruce Patty on Pacifica KPFT Houston, 91.9 on the dial for our friends in Huntsville, 90.1 right here in Houston. Friends and family sharing stories is one of the most powerful ways to connect, particularly during this holiday season, thanks to strong supporters of our program. I mentioned radio. If you don't have a radio, can you guys imagine not having a radio? I mean, growing up, right? Little transit. I have a real quick story. I had this little red Panasonic radio that I got at Radio Shack. I don't know, when I was like maybe 14, I don't know. And I used to have it on my office desk at school. And a student came in once and asked, true story, and asked, "What is that?" I said, "It's a radio. A radio. You turn it on, you listen to music." And he looked at me, he smiled, and he said, "No, really, what is it?" I said, "It's a radio. I'm telling you the truth." Yeah. I proved it to him. He says, "My God, it's still working." I said, "Yeah, it's still working. They used to make stuff that worked in those days." He said, "Can I take a picture?" I said, "Sure." So, you know, I've got the camera, I've got the radio, and he said, no, I want to take a picture with the radio, just a selfie. I said, oh, okay, fine. I mean, for some reason, man, you know, radios are just, I don't know, you know, we're sitting here doing a radio show, but you don't need a radio to listen to it. And that's good. That is good. But I just can't fathom not having a radio. I don't know. Bruce, you know, I know that you are, that you're grateful, you know, for a lot of the escapades shared with your twin brother. So I thought that you would enjoy some of these. You know, what did the drummer call his twin daughters? Remember that one? I think I shared that. And a one, not a two.
Oh, that's it.
I've got a lot of groans I can hear from all listeners right now. A lot of groans. You know, I found out today that I have an identical brother. I got so emotional when we finally met. I was beside myself. I got more, but the groans are just overwhelming. They're a little too much for me. Now, your next story, Bruce, is simply called Gratitude, and it's as poignant as it is unpretentious. Tell us the story.
Well, you know, I have to get out of Mexico City to go to Chicago. Speaking of gratitude, Brian sets me up at his apartment without rent, and he has just gotten married, too. But, good for me that I can now take auditions around the country, because I really want to get an orchestra job in the United States. And I meet up with the freelancers. I play in the Lyric Opera, and the principal of the Lyric Opera is Rachel Wicks. She says to me, you know, you're taking auditions. Why don't you go to my husband? He plays in the Chicago Symphony. He'll help you out. He just plays somebody in San Francisco Symphony. So I go to him, and I do take lessons with him. He's really terrific. He can recognize if I haven't practiced enough. I mean, that's a talent right there. And so I step it up a notch, and then and I'm getting close. But every time I meet with him, he makes a comment about my violin bow, of all things. You know, it's just not the right sound. I think we need to get you another bow. Well, you know, bows can be expensive, and I do pretty well anyway with the bows that I've got and the violin I have. But I do get close. I get a runner-up in Houston Symphony, believe it or not. And he calls down there, Eric Wicks calls a friend who was on that committee, you know, what's with Bruce? And said, well, yeah, I don't know, maybe something about the sound. Oh, okay. Well, then he tells me this. We're going to go down to Bonifuci downtown. We're going to buy you we're going to get you a French bow. We go downtown. There's a famous violin shop. Got any French bows? Yeah, we have this Fatigue. He takes Victor Fatigue. He takes the bow. He plays two notes on it, hands it to me. He says, buy this, with that tone of voice, buy this. So, okay, well, you know, that's going to set me back a few dollars. A French bow in the early 20th century. This one was $3,500 in 1981. That's a lot of money. I go to a colleague in the symphony, another one. He said, I don't know, a bow's a bow. I play on this bow. I don't even know who made this bow. It plays fine with me. But I decided to buy the bow anyway. So I take it, and I play the next audition, which happens to be the Dallas Symphony, and I win the job. I guess that bow made the difference. And so about 35 years later, I'm thinking about that teacher. You know, how grateful I am. I'm grateful for my parents for giving me all those lessons. And I had some prominent teachers, too. But this guy was the obscure one that really helped me the most when I really needed it the most. So I do look him up. I give him a phone call. He's in his 90s now. And he just gives me one-word answers, like, hey, Eric. Thank you for all the help that you gave me back in 40 years. You remember me back then? Yes, he says. I just want to thank you again for helping me. You're welcome. How are you doing? Are you still teaching? Yes. Just one word answers, you know. Well, I just want to thank you again for helping me all those years, those years ago. It was a blessing. You're welcome. Have a nice day. goodbye. But you know, anyway, it was nice to connect with him to show him my gratitude. But he was a one word answer kind of guy, and which reminds me of another student, if I have a minute, who was I had him on Wednesday nights, and he was so difficult. He was so slow in learning. He just ruined my nights. You know, for two years on Wednesdays, you know, he'd come, Zach, and finally, I told his mom, you know, we have to switch teachers here. And she said, oh, I'm so grateful to you because, you know, he's dyslexic. And he did so much better in school classes when he was taking violin lessons. Oh, I wish you had told me this, but nonetheless, I think we need to switch teachers. Well, about 5 years later, Zach comes up. He finds me backstage at the symphony. And he says, hey, Mr. Batty, guess what? I just got into medical school in, Texas A&M at Galveston, and I want to be a brain surgeon. How's that for a story?
Oh, my God. That's riveting. That really is. That is as short and as poignant as they come. Gratitude is incredible, isn't it? You know, these are really critical stories this time of year.
And this time of year, we have no idea
the impact that we make on others. Yeah. Oh. You know, Steve, your story has a title that kind of smacks of an epiphany, confirmation. There is a God. Tell us that story.
I want to tell Bruce what I told him. I heard this story the other day. He said he told me that, and I said, "Well, he's not going to be my brain surgeon." But, okay. Well, this isn't, we're all searching for God, trying to validate God. Where is God? Is there a God? And this is just, like you said, an epiphany. That's exactly what this is about. So in marriage number two, it was a blended family, and we had four children, and each of them were the same ages. So we used to refer to them as the lost twins. And the funny thing about them is if you switched them, if you said who belonged to who, you would have gotten it wrong, because my son was light-complected, blonde-haired, so was my oldest non-biological daughter, and vice versa with the other two pair of daughters. This is a story of blended families and how we get together. You know, the one thing when you're a step-parent, it's something you got to really learn how to be a step-parent. And because, you know, you have your own kids since they began at birth. You've got, you've got history. You got culture between you. You've got a lot of things. And then all of a sudden you're with these other kids, who just show up. And how do you have the same feeling for them that you had for the ones you've been with your whole life? And I thought, sure, I like these kids. They're great. But how do I get that feeling that I have with my biological kids? And sure enough, over time, that happens. So I would differentiate. I wouldn't differentiate between them. And that does happen with time. And I remember one day, two non-biologicals were there while my kids weren't there, and they said, you always are better to your kids than you are to us. And I said, listen, let's get something straight. I hate you all the same. And I never heard another word about that afterwards. Where their culture, where our traditions and our come togetherness of all places started to come together, and we were building our own memories, is when we had to take the family dog to be put down. Their family dog originally, and they asked me to go with them, and I was like, wow, you know, I knew I was being ushered in. So when you have four kids, everybody's, oh my God, how do you raise that many kids? What's how do you manage that? Well, it was the easiest duty I've ever had. The kid part of the marriage was always terrific, but my oldest daughter, non-biological, her name was Laurel. Laurel is one of the strongest, most bullheaded kids that ever walked God's earth. She's incredibly defiant, all the things that count. I mean, you fight your way through everything with her growing up and raising her. She came to a time, and this was really interesting with my second wife. These kids were not Jewish, but my kids were gonna go to Hebrew school at that time. And she thought it would be a good idea for her kids who were secular. She was raised Southern Baptist, but like I say, they had a secular family. She said, I think it'd be a good idea if my kids would go too. And they did. And no complaints. But Laurel she loved going to Temple Shalom. She loved going to class. She later on became an assistant teacher through high school. Was in the Temple Youth Group as a officer. And we had a rabbi at the time, Rabbi Lyon of Temple Beth Israel in Houston. He was at Temple Shalom at that time.
Oh, very well. He's our rabbi. Yep.
Beautiful guy. Give him my regards. I love him. So we had a meeting one day because Laurel also went on for confirmation, which is in 11th grade, you know, doing the classes for that. And we had a meeting with Rabbi Lyon. And she wanted to investigate converting to Judaism at that time. And so he says to us in this meeting, and I'm so proud of her that she's gone this far. My only kid, not even born into the faith, went all the way through what most kids don't. And he says, when you are confirmed, you will be officially Jewish. So that night, when they have the confirmation, it's one of my most proudest moments of my life. And if I had to say, what was this marriage all about that had failed? It is something intervened in there. Who could turn this kid who nobody could tell anything? If I would have mandated that she go do any of those things, it wouldn't have happened. So there's a God out there. Only God could make something happen with this beautifully defiant young lady.
Yeah, I love the passion that you have in telling these stories, because I have to tell you, the fact that you have equal as much passion with your non-biologicals as your biologicals is pretty impressive. I know that both of you remember Mike Lublein. You know, to our listeners, I mentioned him before. He died nearly 2 years ago and was a friend about whom I told a story at the Moth and on YouTube. I couldn't attend his funeral, and this isn't the story that I'm making reference to. It's something that I wrote to include at his service, kind of a short eulogy that I wasn't able to give, and I thought this would be a nice memory to share in this program. I was unable to attend Mike's funeral. However, it's no hyperbole when I say my heart is there. I've known Mike since we were four. Almost every significant childhood episode consisted of some involvement with him. I can give you a rundown of our goofy escapades, but more important, Mike and I resurrected many of them every day for a week before he died. We started by naming every kid in our K through third grade class in the pictures, the kind that Bruce sent to me a while back. He knew quite a few. Unfortunately, he also remembered me peeing in my pants in kindergarten and told me how embarrassed he was to know me. I was 5 years old, Mike, I said. It was still embarrassing, he told me, in his dying bed, right? He couldn't help but telling me that, even though he was near death. Mike told me how much he loved playing ball in the street because it was safe. Imagine that, safe, playing in the street. We slept over each other's houses all the time and looked forward to tuna sandwiches and French fries served up generously by his dad the next day. He told me how much he loved my grandparents, and I told him how much they loved him back. I asked him, what was your favorite moment in life? Unflinchingly, he replied, the day Mitchell came home. The day before Mike passed, I asked him to give me a sign that he's all right once he settles down with everyone who loves him and are waiting to see him. He said he would. I look forward to it, Mike. I told him that Mitchell, his adopted son, is his son for life and always will be there for eternity. He's you, loving and kind. Our lives, simply put, are a series of stories. They are moments frozen in time, and when we tell them, we let them thaw and unfold into recollections that define us. We are born a blank page. Our life is a story, and our story is our life. Something is happening in our story, and we don't know it yet. We're just in it. We live in story like fish lives in water. We swim through words and images, siphoning story through our minds the way a fish siphons water through its gills. That's what Mike and I did together all of our lives, and we put it in gear a few days before he died. Every word Michael Lublin conveyed had meaning, and every action carried love. He had honor and dignity and knew how to protect the dignity of those who surrounded him. That isn't my impression, that's a fact, because Mike effortlessly stretched the boundaries of the human heart. Thank you, Mike, for giving me that chance after. In a moment, Bruce is going to play Greensleeves, the Ralph Vaughan Williams version, a perfect conclusion, I think, to the beginning of this holiday season. But it's important to know that this kind of a program is one that is so terribly, terribly critical to all of us. Thank you, Bruce Patty and Steve Weintraub, for proving that stories are transfer. Let's enjoy Greensleeves and peace.
We're here early before they wake up. We stay late. We stay informed. We invest in the latest technology.
We take the time to train the next generation of doctors and nurses. We work together to make sure we heal their bodies and their minds.
We do this not because it's our job, but because this is about our veterans' lives. This is our mission. More than 300,000 of us working as one, together with families and loved ones. No matter where they live in this country, we'll be there.
We all come together and stand together to serve our veterans. We stand strong, united. Stand with us in caring for our veterans.
We get letters, emails, and phone calls saying thanks. Thanks for playing a piece of music. Thanks for keeping listeners up to date on events in our area. Thanks for introducing our fans to new talent. Now we're asking you to say thanks in a very tangible way. We're asking you to make a pledge. When you call with your contribution, you'll be providing us with the resources we need to keep bringing you the new talent, to keep informing you on events at clubs and concert halls, to bring you great news, to keep playing that favorite tune you can hear nowhere else. Call now with your pledge, 715 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. You can also help on our secure website at kpft.org. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. KPFT, Houston.
Did you know that you can double your value to KPFT as a listener sponsor by